Now, these last two evenings we have looked at Exodus chapter 1 and Exodus chapter 2. And we finished the chapter last night with Moses in the backside of the desert. But before we go into Exodus 3, please, I would like you to turn just to a very short passage in Hebrews chapter 11. And we'll have a look at the Spirit's inspired comment on Moses' great decision. Hebrews 11 at verse 24. By faith Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. And in these verses, the Spirit of God, centuries later, draws attention to that which enabled Moses to make his great decision. You'll appreciate that when he was 40 years of age, he emerged as the finished product of Egyptian culture and learning. He was a man who was in possession of the wisdom of the Egyptians. He was a man who was mighty in word and in deed. He had been trained in Egypt's colleges and universities. And no doubt he had his foot on the steps to Egypt's throne. But as we saw last night, there came a day when he threw in his lot with a nation of slaves, a nation of serfs, people who were being ground down in bitter bondage and slavery in Egypt. But there came a day when he made his choice. And we saw last night, when I was speaking to you on the dignity of motherhood, that there came a day when his mother's teaching proved superior to Egypt's learning. He never forgot what his mother taught him. And all the learning of the Egyptians could never remove it. Those of you who were present last Thursday evening when I ministered the word here at the prayer meeting may recall that I drew your attention to teach your young people that when they go to colleges and universities and they listen to the rationalistic, intelligent and brilliant explanations of the professors and their lecturers, teach them to remember that these men, if they are not Christians, do not know. You remember we emphasized 1 Corinthians 2 verse 14, the natural man receiveth not the things of God, they are foolishness unto him. It matters not how clever he might be, he just does not know. And that would save our young people from their faith being assailed by the rationalistic interpretations and reasonings of men. Isn't it wonderful to think that Egypt's culture and education never undermined Moses' faith? It only took time. And says the inspired writer in verse 24 here, by faith Moses. That's good. It was contrary to nature. He had everything that Egypt could offer. But you see, faith moves contrary to nature. Faith gives a man or a woman capacity to take in that there are things far more important than what's material. By faith Moses, when he was come to years, that is, in the fullness of maturity. It wasn't the quick decision of a young man that maybe he would regret one day. When he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Was he offered something? Was something placed before him that brought him to the crunch? And was it possible that as he stood there having before him all the glory and honor and wealth of leadership, that he refused, choosing rather. Listen to what it says. Deliberately he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God. So the choice was between Egypt and the people of God. The choice was between all that the Egyptian system could offer and fellowship with God's people. You remember that I went into detail on Tuesday night on the difference between the Sodom system, the Egyptian system, the Jericho system, and the Babylonian system, and sought to teach you all that the Egyptian system meant and what it offered. Here was a man with Egypt at his feet, and he chose rather. Think of it. He chose hardship to comfort. He chose shame to fame. He chose reproach to honor. He chose affliction to pleasure. He chose the wilderness to the court. Ultimately and finally, he chose to suffer rather than sin. Tremendous, isn't it? He refused, choosing rather. Verse 25 says, verse 26, he esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. What does that mean? For after all, Christ wasn't born for thousands of years later. In what way did he esteem the reproach of Christ? Well, he esteemed the reproach of fellowship with Messiah's people, with the people of God. That's what it means. It's the reproach of Christ as associated with God's people. These people lived one day for the revelation of the Christ, the Messiah. And there came a day when he esteemed the reproach of a fellowship with God's people greater riches than all that Egypt could offer. That's it. For Mark you, if you're going to make all that this world can offer everything to you, then number one, right at the very beginning, you sacrifice fellowship with God's people. Possible to be in the assembly and not in fellowship. It says that he esteemed this reproach. Doesn't say that he bore up to it as well as he could. He counted it an honor to suffer reproach with the people of God than to, yes, esteemed it greater riches for the spiritual millionaires are the men and women who know most about reproach for Christ. Finally, for I must get on, tell us, Moses, why you did it. Moses, do come forward and explain to us in Vancouver your motives, your reasonings. What moved you, Moses? Yes, he said, I'll tell you. I had respect unto the recompense of the reward. That's it. That is, Moses acted in the time now present in the light of the time that was then present. Moses lived in the light of eternity. That's what makes us an enigma to the world. They don't understand us. Why should we voluntarily give up its honors and its pleasures and its glory? People don't understand why we go against the stream. Over yonder in Reading Avenue in Kilmarnock, we very recently have new neighbours beside us. And of course they are only gradually learning the kind of life that we live. And on occasions they'll say, now, where are you going off to now? And I'll tell them, you see, Vancouver for instance, and they'll look at me. I know what they're thinking. But you see, values are different. Priorities are far apart. For we live our lives in the light of the future. Now, very soon, we're all going to be before the judgment seat. Far sooner, maybe, than we anticipate. Now, I would like to give you the credit that I would like you to give me. That up yonder in that day the Lord shall say, well done, good and faithful servant. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't think that's right. I think that's proper. But remember this, brethren and sisters. If you want that commendation at the judgment seat, then you'll need to begin at least to live that kind of life now. Now, back now to Exodus, please, will you? Chapter 3, verse 1. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert, and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. The angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. And when the Lord, when Jehovah saw that he turned aside to see Elohim, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. And he said, Draw not nigh hither, put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Moreover he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Now, you'll recall in dealing with chapter 2, that I drew your attention that Exodus 2 covers 80 years in the life of Moses. 40 years in Egypt and 40 years in the backside of the desert, and Moses begins his greatest work for God when two-thirds of his life was gone. Now, he spent 40 years in the backside of the desert tending sheep. Seemed a waste of time, didn't it? How will God produce leaders if he's going to take all that time with everybody? Yet it was very necessary. You will appreciate, brethren and sisters, that there's no shortcut to this. You will understand that there is a time of privacy with God ere you move out publicly. That was true with Moses, 40 years in the backside of the desert ere he reached the burning bush. That was true with Elijah, years in the fastnesses of Gilead before he showed himself unto Ahab. It was true of John the Baptist, he spent years in the desert ere his appearing unto Israel. It was true of Saul of Tarsus, 3.5 years in Arabia ere he came out to preach. So it was with the Son of God. 30 years in private for 3 in public. Amazing. The ratio of private to public was 10 to 1. Is that our weakness? Is that what's wrong with the preachers? Listen. Yonder in the solitude of the desert, he's alone with the Almighty. The devil can't gild the desert sands. There's no false colours there. Everything's real. The din and bustle of the commercial world is unknown. The crash in the monetary world is never heard. There's no lust of the eye to dim. No lust to dim the eye. No pride to swell the heart. No humans to flatter you or depress you. Just God and you. Strange, isn't it? When I talk to you of Moses, Elijah, the Baptist, Saul of Tarsus, in those years of privacy and quietness, there are no details of any kind. That's remarkable. The reason for that is this, that every man's preparation is different. No two men are the same. If the thing had been left on record, we would be making it a standard. But God prepares his men in secret, and there is no standard method. Every man is different. Don't you understand, brethren and sisters, that you can't beat God's school? This is where the Bible colleges fail. They'll take you all in for a 2 or 3 year course, and they'll take you all through Mark's Gospel, and they'll take you all through another book, and you'll all be taught the same things and come out in the same mould. God doesn't work like that. That's man's ideas of things. That's not how God does things. Don't get caught up with wrong ideas. So yonder in the quietness he's prepared. And one day it happened. He reached the bush. Would you allow me to call it the transfiguration of the commonplace? Could I talk to you about a day that began as an ordinary day and finished as extraordinary? Could I talk to you about a day that began with sheep and finished with God? One day as he walked through, comes to the mountain of God, and lo, suddenly his eye catches a thorn bush on fire. He thinks nothing for a moment, and then suddenly it dawns on him, it's still burning. The bush was not consumed. Now he's going to beat God. Oh, never mind for a moment what the commentators say and the scholars. They've made this the incarnation, and they've made this the suffering of Israel. What did it mean to Moses? First of all, it meant to him the presence of God. Now, he never forgot it. Years later, at the end of his life in Deuteronomy, he talks about the goodwill of him that dwelt in the bush. And heaven never forgot it. For Christ in his ministry, drawing attention to I am the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, says you'll find it in the section concerning the bush. Verse 6 says this, Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Know anything about it? Wasn't this where Isaiah was?
I saw Adonai high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple.
Wasn't this what Saul of Tarsus was when he got a vision of the Christ exalted?
Did not John and Patmos fall down as dead before the glory of the priest judge?
Tell me, brethren, have you seen God? You know what I mean? The presence of God. Secondly, he's deeply impressed with the holiness of God. How did he feel? When out from the bush there came a voice that said,
take off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground.
The holiness of God, essential, pure, intrinsic, burning light. The voice of God. Moses! Moses! The double call. Wonder how he felt. God knows you.
40 years in the backside of the desert away from Egypt, unknown, unrecognized, unheralded, and unsung. God knows all about it. The time has come. The hour has struck.
Verse 6. Moses, listen to me. I am the God of Abraham, the God of electing grace.
I am the God of Isaac, the God of resurrection life.
I am the God of Jacob, the God of divine purpose and long suffering. Verse 7, I have seen the affliction of the people. I have heard their cry. I know their sorrows, the declaration of God's observation. He says, I am come down to deliver them. the wonder of divine deliverance, verse 8, to bring them out and bring them into a land, a good land and a large, extensive and room for all, a land flowing with milk and honey in all its richness and fullness and blessedness, enough in it to sustain the people. Verse 9, now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel is come unto me. I have seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppressed them. Verse 10. Come now. And I will send thee unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. So the time has come to go. All right? For the glory of the hour. A personal call by God. The time come to do his greatest work. Now please, verse 11. And Moses said unto God, who am I, that I should go unto Pharaoh, and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? So he's not going. He's not going. This is the first of four excuses. 40 years ago he was desperate to go. Now right, he slew the Egyptian thinking that all Israel would know that he was the deliverer, Acts 7, but they didn't. Now he doesn't want to go when the time has come. Now, let me draw your attention to a strange thing. Let me go back to the first 40 years when he came out, and feeling that he was God's deliverer, he smote the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Now, it was God's purpose that Moses would be the deliverer of Israel, isn't that right? At 40 years of age, Moses comes out and he has a definite exercise and desire to fulfill the role and be the deliverer. Now, wouldn't you have thought that divine purpose and human exercise would have coalesced? Isn't that what you've been taught? Isn't that right? That if God has a purpose for you and you have an exercise about it, that God will complete it. But it didn't happen that way at all. He was 40 years too early. His exercise was right, but the time was not opportune. He was ill-equipped, but didn't know it. Lots of young people like that. Now listen to me. It may be that God has a purpose in life for you. It may be that your exercise at the present moment is perfectly correct and true. But it could be that you're too early and you'll need to wait God's time. And the waiting time will prove your mettle. Now, now the time has struck with God. God has prepared and fashioned the man. And so God says, come now and I will send thee unto Pharaoh. And he says, Lord, who am I? Who am I? His excuse is lack of fitness. I'm not the man. I'm not the man. Who am I? Verse 12. And God said, certainly I will be with thee, and this shall be a token unto thee that I have sent thee. Do you remember? Do you remember? Now back to the conference again, please. Do you remember the day I spoke to you on Gideon? The same thing? God says, now, come on, Moses, I want you to go. Gideon, I want you to go. And Gideon says, Lord, you've come to the wrong person. He says, don't you know that we've no money? My family is poor. Don't you know that I'm the youngest in my father's house and I've no status of any kind? So Moses is saying the same. Lord, you've come to the wrong man. To each of these men, God says, certainly I will be with thee. I, thee. One man and God are invincible. One man and God is a majority. You remember we talked about it? Moses and God, Gideon and God, Samson and God, Elijah and God, Daniel and God, Peter and God, James and God, John and God, Paul and God, Timothy and God, Livingstone and God, Luther and God, Whitefield and God, Wesley and God. That's it. Will you be God's man? Says God, I will be with thee. Say, where would you not go with deity at your back? Say, where would you not go if God says, certainly I will be with thee? Wonderful, isn't it?
Eh? Brother, now go anywhere.
I'd face any man
with God at my back.
I would count it a supreme dignity and honor. Verse 13. And Moses said unto God, Behold, when I come unto the children of Israel, and shall say unto them, The God of your fathers hath sent me unto you, and they shall say to me, What is his name? What shall I say unto them? Now please, he is not now stating a lack of fitness. He is stating a lack of knowledge. He says, What can I say to them? If they say, if I go and say that you have sent me, and they say, What is his name? Verse 14. All right, says God. I am that I am. Moses, go and tell them I am have sent thee. And here we come across this peculiar title that I'll explain to you in a moment. Moses, you go to the people and you say, I am that I am have sent you. What does it mean? Now listen carefully. I am that I am declares first of all the uniqueness of God. I am that I am. There is no one else like him. You cannot compare him to another. He is solitary, alone, isolated, unique, incomparable. I am that I am the uniqueness of God. Secondly, I am that I am the unchangeableness of God. I am that I am. He is the God that never alters, never varies, never vacillates, never changes. I, the Lord, change not. Everyone else will change, but God remains the same. I am that I am the unchangeableness of God. Thirdly, I am that I am the self-sufficiency of God.
I am that I am. The self-sufficiency of God. You cannot add to him and you cannot take from him.
He is what he is. He is sufficient in the fullness of his person, of his glory, and of his provision. What every servant needs, God has got. I am that I am the self-sufficiency of God. Come again. I am that I am. Not only the uniqueness of God, not only the unchangeableness of God, not only the self-sufficiency of God, I am that I am the sovereignty of God. The God that's supreme above all others. The God against whom no man can prosper. You must either bow or perish forever. The God against who is overwhelming in his majesty, in his glory, in his supremacy, in his might, in his sovereignty. I am that I am the sovereignty of God. Finally and fifthly, I am that I am not only the uniqueness of God, not only the unchangeableness of God, not only the all-sufficient self-sufficiency of God, not only the sovereignty of God, but the eternity of God. I am that I am. The God that never dies. The God that never ceases to be. The God that ever is, always has been, and always will be. The God that straddles time. The God that belongs to eternity. I am that I am. And behind Moses there stood God in his uniqueness, in his unchangeableness, in his self-sufficiency, in his sovereignty, and in his eternity. And says Moses, listen, you tell them, I am that I am hath sent thee. Wonderful. Knowledge? Knowledge? Why, he overwhelms them with it.
Listen. Centuries later,
there stood one day in Palestine a man dressed like a Galilean peasant. And standing there, he said, I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the door. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the true vine.
That's it. None else than our Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the person that stands behind me tonight and will stand behind you, the great eternal I am. Jesus Christ, the same, yesterday, today, and forever. He'll never fail you. The same in the yesterday of your experience, the today of your necessity, the tomorrow of your expectation. I am that I am.
One day, Paul gave witness and paid tribute to the grace of God. Do you know what he said?
He said, by the grace of God, I am what I am. Got that? I am what I am. Not even Paul could say, I am that I am.
That's deity. That belongs alone to the sacredness of the Godhead. I am that I am hath sent thee. Wonderful. Now please, knowledge.
Knowledge, Moses?
Verse 15. He tells them what to say to the children of Israel. Verses 16 and 17, he tells them what to say to the elders. Verse 18, he tells them what to say to Pharaoh. 22, he prophesies what will happen when they go to Pharaoh. Something that Moses forgot. Knowledge.
As he declares himself,
gives them instructions for every part of the road. Tell the people this. Tell the elders that.
Tell Pharaoh this. And I tell you what Pharaoh will do.
Knowledge.
Most intelligent man in the world at that time was Moses. Knowledge, brethren. Listen, now I use the Christian week.
Square your shoulders and get your chin up. You're the most intelligent people in the world. We are. God has taught us. God has told us. We know. You make no mistake about it. We know.
It's enshrined in the sacred text. Knowledge. Chapter 4, verse 1. Moses answered and said, but behold, they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my word, my voice, for they will say, the Lord hath not appeared unto thee.
Now what do you make of that? He's still not going.
He's not now declaiming lack of witness.
He's not now talking about lack of knowledge, he's talking about lack of authority. He says, when I go to them, he says, they'll not believe me nor hearken to my voice. They only need to say,
the Lord hath not appeared unto thee. And he says, what can I say? Now you have a wee bit of sympathy for the man here.
You will understand, won't you, that he had been separated from these people for 40 years.
Many of them wouldn't even know of him.
It was a bit of a far-off story now about the young man that surrendered the throne. He'd been lost sight of. He had fled from Pharaoh. And now he's going to meet the people and he says, Lord, what can I say if they say, well, the Lord hasn't appeared to you? After all, when Moses would appear before the people, there's no Shekinah glory above his head.
There's no bush burning at his side. There's no miraculous voice coming.
Can you appreciate it? As he claims lack of authority. Authority, Moses? You raised the question of your fitness and I told you all your fitness that you need at the moment is for me to be behind you. You claim lack of knowledge and I've given you plenty. Authority, Moses? Power? All right. Verse 2. What's that in your hand, Moses?
It's the rod.
All right, Moses, throw it in the ground, will you? Threw it in the ground, it became a serpent, and Moses ran away. Moses, away back and take it with the tail. Back he went, took it with the tail, and it became a rod. What's that?
Authority, Moses, power. I'll give you power over all the forces of evil. I'll give you power over satanic force, satanic evil.
Authority, Moses, power. Verse 6. Put your hand into your breast.
And it goes.
Bring it out, Moses. Leprous. Struck with the dread disease. Put it back in again, Moses. Bring it out. Clean. What's this? Power over disease. Power to inflict the most dreadful calamities and yet power to remove them. Isn't that right? Isn't that what he did with the plague?
Power, Moses. Authority. Listen, Moses, verse 8 onward. If perchance they won't believe these things, then Moses, verse 9, he said, take the water of the river and pour it on the dry land, and it will become blood. Power of death! For if the water's turned to blood, everybody will die. Moses, power! I'll give you power over the forces of evil. I'll give you power over disease. I'll give you power over death. And when you go to verse 31, the last verse of chapter 4, the people believed when they did the miracles. Now, right. Well, now, isn't that wonderful, brethren? Eh? Now, see, you and I have been down the road as fast as we could go if God was promising all this. Look now, please, will you? Verse 10. Moses said unto the Lord, O Lord, I am not eloquent, neither heretofore nor since hast thou spoken unto thy servant. But I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue. Some boy this.
I tell you, the first excuse is lack of fitness. The second excuse is lack of knowledge. The third excuse is lack of authority. The fourth excuse is lack of utterance.
Oh, this is the age-old one, isn't it? Isn't that right? How to speak. And if you go to the Bible colleges and the universities, they'll give you a course in elocution. This best question of how you ought to speak. You know, in their day, they didn't think Paul was a very great speaker. He hadn't the oratory of the Greeks. And mind you, he wasn't too keen to come with excellency of man's wisdom. He preferred, as I taught you last Thursday night at the prayer meeting, to teach in words that the Holy Ghost teaches.
I don't know whether he had a slight impediment or not, but he's certainly drawing attention to the fact that he lacks utterance. Now, verse 11. Now, here's an insight. The Lord said unto him, who hath made man's mouth? Who maketh the dumb or the deaf or the seeing or the blind? Have not I the Lord? Now, he's saying, listen, Moses. Very often behind the law of heredity, there is the law of God.
Listen, Moses, I'll accept responsibility for any defects you've got in utterance.
In other words, God is vindicating his choice of Moses. Now he says, therefore go, verse 12, I will be with thy mouth and teach thee what thou shalt say. Why, isn't that wonderful? Isn't it? Imagine God. God saying to any man, listen, I'll be with you.
I'll go with you. He says, I'll be with thy mouth and I'll teach you what to say. Oh, brother.
Isn't this wonderful? In this day,
is this not made true in the power of the Spirit of God?
Happy's the man. Happy's the preacher. Happy's the servant. Who has God at his back. And to whom God says,
I'll be with your mouth. I'll teach you what to say. And if a man is under the control of the Spirit of God and he says things, now I'm making the qualification. If a man is under the control of the Spirit of God when he rises to speak, and I drew attention last Thursday night to this basic principle, that when a man goes on a platform, the audience are entitled to understand that this man has come from the Spirit of God with his teaching. I tell you, there's a day of account coming for the preachers. But if a man gets up, controlled by the Spirit of God and speaks, don't you be too hard on him. For he's only telling you what God told him to tell you.
Now,
you remember last night? Now maybe you're beginning to get a little insight into the loneliness of this business up here. It's a lonely place. For you're under the control of God. And you must teach what God teaches you. It's a lonely place.
Verse 13. And Moses said, O my Lord, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him whom thou wilt send. What does that mean? Now, he's not making any excuses now.
Verse 13 just means this. Listen, Lord, you can send who you like, but I'm not going. That's all.
Just as blunt and as plain as that. You can send whoever you please. I'm not going.
Do you remember last night I raised with you
the fact that, generally speaking, we expect that a man must be fully consecrated to God for God to use him? And here God's greatest servant,
one of his greatest servants in the Old Testament, and God has answered him graciously, patiently, with long suffering, and at the end of the interview he says, you can send who you like, I'm not going.
Verse 14. The Lord's angry. Now he says, is not Aaron the Levite thy brother? I know that he can speak well. Now it was true. Aaron could talk. Aaron could speak. Now he says he cometh forth to meet thee. So God was working in Aaron's heart to meet his brother whom he hadn't seen for 40 years. Verse 15. Moses, thou shalt speak to him and put words in his mouth, and I will be with thy mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you what you shall do. He shall be thy spokesman unto the people. And he shall be, even he shall be to thee instead of a mouth, and thou shalt be to him instead of God. And thou shalt take this rod in thine hand, wherewith thou shalt do signs. And when that's all over, Moses is ready to go.
Strange, isn't it? Isn't it? He didn't want to go with God, but he's quite happy to go along with him. My, we're human, aren't we? The person that we see means more to us than the person we can't see.
And you know, there is now brought into fellowship two brothers.
And I want you to understand this. That Aaron was never a Moses. Is that clear? Now I'll prove that tomorrow night to you. That Aaron was never a Moses.
But God brought them into fellowship pro tem. He says to Moses, now Moses, Aaron will be your mouthpiece. I'll speak to you and you'll speak to him and he'll speak to the people.
That was only a temporary arrangement.
Isn't that right? Read your Bible carefully. When it comes to pronouncing the 10 plagues, have you ever noticed? The first 3 plagues,
the Lord said unto Moses, say unto Aaron. The 4th and 5th plagues, the Lord said unto Moses. The 6th plague, the Lord said unto Moses and Aaron. And the rest of the plagues, the Lord said unto Moses.
And Aaron goes out the picture. Ultimately, this man will stride through the courts of Egypt, growing in stature and in dignity and in might and in moral excellence. Verse 1 of chapter 7, I have made thee God to Pharaoh. He'll stand before Pharaoh as God. When, as things move on, you'll find this, that when you come to chapter 11, verse 8, that Moses strides out from Pharaoh's presence angry, reflecting the anger of God to Pharaoh, and tells Pharaoh, listen, these thy servants shall come unto me and bow down themselves unto me, and they'll tell us to get out, and only when they tell us to go will we go. What a man. Yonder he strode through Egypt, the man that once wielded a shepherd's rod, wields the rod of God. He'll lift that rod and he'll bring the judgments of God down. He'll strike terror into the whole of Egypt. He'll bring the mighty empire down to its knees and well nigh destroy it. He'll raise his hand and the plagues will cease. Wonderful man, Moses. You would hardly believe it's the same man that was making his excuses. Hardly believe it. Now listen to this and I'll finish. Moses. the child of a slave, yet the son of a princess. Born in a hut, yet lived in a palace. Inherited poverty, yet enjoyed unlimited wealth. A leader of armies, yet a keeper of flocks. The mightiest of warriors, yet the meekest of men. Educated at court, yet dwelt in the desert. Possessed the wisdom of Egypt, yet the faith of a child. Fitted for the city, yet wandered in the wilderness. Tempted by the pleasures of sin, he endured the hardness of virtue. Backward in speech, yet he talked with God. He had the rod of a shepherd, yet wielded the power of the eternal. A fugitive from Pharaoh, yet the ambassador of heaven. Died on Mount Nebo, yet appeared on the Mount of Transfiguration. Wonderful Moses. So may the Lord bless his word.